the Philosophy of Psychoanalysis. The lecture you are about to listen to was created by Associate Professor Doris McIlwain. This course has been made publicly available, but was recorded for a live student audience. Please enjoy. Lecture 23, Cascading Constraints of Personality Development.
So what I'm trying to outline today is the model of personality development that I've been working on for a number of years, which I call the Cascading Constraints Model of Personality Development. And I'll be speaking about that over the course of personality this year. So what I see cascading constraints as being is that even though I do believe that we are all made up of traits and motives and dispositions and schemas and scripts, and narratives and things like that, it does seem to be the case that there are certain kinds of clusterings that arise in life more commonly than other forms of clustering. And so what I think happens is that you hit a number of points in life where if you take one path, certain options open up for you. If you take the other path at that turning point, other options open up for you. And so progressively you move further and further along a particular developmental trajectory or a particular developmental path. So to take the example, if I decide that I don't trust the world and I don't trust people, I've taken a path that quite powerfully shapes what else is likely to occur for me in life. And so that's one of the ways that I'm going to be illustrating developmental paths today. It's got a cumulative effect. It's hard to come back from distrust. That's one of the first sort of decisions, if you like, that you make in life. But once you are not trusting of others, the world is a different place for you, in a sense. So in a sense, if we're working as psychologists, at a research level, sure, we want to know the developmental pathways because we want to be able to model them theoretically and statistically and otherwise. But if you're working clinically, you want to work out at what point did something go wrong for this person? Because that might also be what I need to do as a site of remediation so that things can become different for them now, you know, to undo the effects of development in some ways. So cascading constraints assumes that if you experience difficulties, these have knock-on effects, they have subsequent effects. And so quite often it seems as though there are personality types in the world or personality disorders. But actually, these are assembled due to contingent life experiences. If I don't trust, then I'm less likely to allow myself to be vulnerable in relationship to others. If I don't let myself be vulnerable in relationship to others, I might be somewhat controlling in my interpersonal relationships. If I'm controlling in my interpersonal relationships, it's likely I will have the following interpersonal problems. Okay, so in other words, there are if-then contingencies, and they dynamically assemble what it feels like to be me. They also dynamically live, sort of assemble what the world feels like for me to live in. Because I live in the world, in a sense, based on the assumptions I make about other people and what's likely to happen. I'm not saying that that's the only world there is. There is a reality that you bump into, but that reality, in a sense, is shaped by what we're looking for or what we notice or what matters to us or what really stands out and strikes us as salient. So personality development, I've suggested, occurs at a number of different levels, the subpersonal, the personal and the cultural. At the subpersonal, which is what we're sort of looking at in the next few lectures, you've got unconscious processes, you've got drives and affects, you've got schemas and the internal working models that you acquire as a result of attachment experiences. Okay, so what I'm doing today is much, much simpler than the trajectory that Drew Weston has in the chapter on personality development that I've put up online for you. That's quite a hard chapter. I think that was probably his master's thesis. Well worth reading, but don't freak out. He's got a huge vocabulary, but there is a very nice trajectory that he's looking at in that chapter. I'm looking at a much more simplified one today. I'm sort of picking three points, really. One is self-other distinctions, how do they arise? Then I'm looking at trust, what makes you trust others or distrust them? And then I want to look at the consequences of that later on, I'm not doing it so much today, What does that mean in terms of our capacity to have empathy for others? And then on to morality, etc. So you can sort of see that I see these have a sort of feeding on, a knock-on effect with each other. So the developmental milestones that I am looking at today is temperament, attunement, attachment, both primary and secondary mechanisms, trust versus distrust. And I also want to then look at views of others that arise and the consequences of our development for how we focus on either the self or the world and others. So that's the kind of trajectory that I'm drawing through personality development. Okay, so the subpersonal. What do we come into the world with? Well, we come into the world motivated. We have drives and we have affects, and they're innate to a certain degree. We also have our temperament. We're either the kind of people that are predominantly active or predominantly inhibited, very broadly speaking. And what these things contribute to our personality is that they're the kind of bodily basis of our experience. In other words, that's the sort of somatic anchor. What's my body like? And what sensory information do I get from my body? That's the somatosensory basis of bodily experience. Now, only some of that ever becomes mental experience. I will never be able to tell you what's happening in my hypothalamus, right? I could do all the introspection courses I like. I will never be able to go, oh, I know what's happening there, right? I can roughly know when I'm hungry on a good day, but, you know, the actual mechanisms that underpin the sensation of hunger, I don't have direct access to. So you've got the bodily basis of your experience, but then are you focused on that at all? If you're introverted, you're likely to be a little bit more focused on your body. If you're extroverted, body, I got a body. Oh, yes, I have bruised myself badly. Gosh, I didn't notice, right? So how attentive are you to it? And how do you attend to that somatosensory stimulation? And then what meaning do you take from that? You know, if your heart's racing, oh, I might die, right? That's not a great way to go. That's the basis of a panic attack. And if you've ever experienced them, they're truly scary things. You've drawn a particularly strong meaning from a set of bodily stimuli. And then that becomes, in part, conscious mental experience. So you can see there's a whole lot going on below the line of water, below the iceberg. You can see the visible iceberg as the conscious, but there's a lot going on underneath that water. Okay, so what contributes to the somatosensory basis of experience? Apologies to those of you who've done philosophy of psychoanalysis. You can have a little snooze for the next two slides because they're familiar to you, but for the rest of you, I need to sort of bring you up to speed. Drives are not all that fashionable in research terms at the moment, and the kind of contemporary researchers tend to label them as affects, even when they're talking about things like hunger and sex. And I would just refer to those as drives. I think those are drives. They're sources of policy. They're bodily sources of policy. In other words, they tell me what I should do if I want to stay alive, or what I should do if I want to propagate the species. And they necessarily make me notice reality, because I can suck my thumb and hallucinate food, but ultimately I'm going to starve unless I get out there and find something I can consume. So the drives make you knock up against reality. They're neurobiological, and lots of people like Joseph Ledoux, Jaak Panksepp, they're trying to map which bits of the brain fire with different kinds of drives and affects, okay? But the interesting thing from my point of view is that they motivate me to find things that I need. In other words, they make me cognize, sense, perceive bits of the world. They drive me. They drive me out into the world to find stuff, to find something that's satisfying. Now, we're born with them, which means that they're rough and ready, because they come from the distal environments of our ancestors, which means they sort of prepare you for some kind of world where you can breathe oxygen and you'll be moving upright and there'll be things you can eat. But they don't prepare you for being Italian or Scottish, you know what I mean? They wire you roughly for an average expectable environment. But how you actually fit the environment in which you find yourself is something that has to be shaped through learning. And so what's interesting is that, sure, they are these biological propensities, these parameters, eat stuff, sleep with people, right? That's about it. But in terms of precise goal-directed activity, they've got to be pretty shaped up by culture. So, for instance, with hunger, you know roughly that hunger is, at a bodily level, when the glucose level has dropped and your liver detects that and your hypothalamus detects that, or if there's something that you feel, you know, about the sort of squeezing of your stomach, or if something in your body goes, I haven't got enough fat at my disposal to survive, and suddenly you're out there. But we don't notice all of that. We just go, food would be nice, right? Subjective feeling. Or where did all the bakeries come from? You know, perceptual salience. The street didn't have so many bakeries until I was hungry. And obviously external processes can activate motivation. You weren't feeling sort of sexually aroused, but somebody very cute walks past and then suddenly you are in that motivational state. So you do stuff that either increases your glucose or reduces your feelings of hunger, but whether it's paella or pasta, it's culture. Likewise with sex, as those of you who are in Giselle's group will know, it can be almost anything that one does to decrease tension. So what you desire and find erotic is inextricably cultural. Freud said that sexuality was like a number of rivers that sort of started at the top of a mountain, and they sort of interwove until when they get to the plains, they're flowing like a single river. But they're not. It's not a singular thing, sexuality. There's a whole lot of different contributions to it, and some of them can be turned up loudly in some of us and turned down in others. Each of us has a very unique sort of sexual recipe, if you like. And you have to take that quite seriously in terms of the activity or the passivity, whether you like to look or be looked at, whether you like to act upon others or be acted upon yourself. Those are the sorts of variables that are, you know, highly variable across people. Okay. In the literature, a lot of psychologists go, affects, emotions, feelings, is there a difference? Some people say, yes, I'll just use them interchangeably. No, don't do that. I think they're quite different and it's confusing, but I think it's worth trying to keep what is known about the differences separate in your mind. There is a lot of confusion in the literature, but some things are more or less agreed upon. And I'm trying to convey to you today some of the things that are more or less agreed upon. Okay, so affect. By and large, when they're referred to as affect programs, it refers to either a set of muscles or glandular responses. They can either be in the face or distributed right throughout the body. And they generate sensory feedback to you saying, something's really good, acceptable, or something's really bad, unacceptable. And all sorts of organized responses get triggered. Now, this happens at the subcortical or the limbic region of the brain. That's the kind of quite ancient sort of nucleus at the center of the brain that can set all sorts of little pathways going right up to the sort of more recent development of the cortex of the brain. But these programs, he says, are innately endowed and genetically inherited, so we're wired with them. But when they're activated, what's so interesting is that they capture us. And they capture us in a signature way, this distributed pattern, like our face changes, our heart changes, our endocrine changes, this whole correlated pattern of responses. That's why when I'm waffling on in the next couple of lectures about emotional soothing, it's a hard thing to achieve. It's very hard to soothe your emotions because they grab your body and they put you into a very strong state, and depending on your temperament, you'll be in a stronger or weaker state, depending on whether you've got a very powerful, active temperament. So, for instance, three of my favorite affects, curiosity, interest, and surprise, are the positive ones. Fear is the one that you really you can't negotiate with. They tend to set you in movement in a particular way. With fear, you want to run. Curiosity, you usually want to explore or approach. It's less directly specified than fear what you're going to do. With surprise, it's like you don't usually approach whatever it is you see, But your eyes go really wide so that you don't miss anything about this new stimulus that you haven't seen before or didn't expect to find in this context. But that's not the full story. It's not like, okay, we're all got these inborn affects, therefore we have the full array in our pantry to cook with, if you like. Because we might have been born in an environment that was so abusive that we just habituated to fear. And actually, we don't respond much to it anymore at all, right? It's a very unusual thing to happen. But it means that if I can't soothe my fear, I don't want to know it's there because there's nothing I can do about it, right? So your manner of attending to it may actually be shaped because there was nobody there to help you deal with it, manage it, and soothe it. So what shapes your somatosensory basis of experience? I'm going to go really fast over the next few slides, not because they don't matter, but because I'm not really emphasizing temperament much this year, so I'm not going to be asking you an exam question on it or a short answer question on it. But just out of sheer scholarship, I feel like if it's something that interests you and you want to do it later on, you know, in an honors project or later in life, you get hired as an RA or something, I just want you to know that there's a whole lot of ways that people look at temperament. So it's kind of like a guided tour of temperament. You don't have to, you know, be too active in the next few slides. So it started with, and probably other courses have told you about this. Have other courses told you about this kind of stuff? Yes, some of you nodding? Good. Okay, so you've got basically two distinct motivational systems, appetitive versus avoidant, positive and negative, respectively. The positive's got the dopamine as the primary transmitter. The negative's the norepinephrine. What is going to be relevant if you read the Soltaris article on the development of psychopathy is that she talks a lot about Koshanska's work with little kids. Because if you've got a fearful little kid, it's much easier to induce empathy-based morality in them. And if you've got a fearless little kid, you've got to choose different parenting strategies if you want that little kid to end up being moral. Strelau says that you end up being highly reactive or not so reactive based on your temperament, and I'm going to talk about him a little bit more in a minute. You've also got Buss and Plowman's behavioral genetics theory of temperament. Look at the sort of variables, so that's what I'm interested in. You've got sociability, you've got activity, and you've got emotionality. Quite like Ising's EPQ, where you've got extroversion, you've got emotional instability. Yeah. So you see some of the variables that are there in personality are also variables that are quite close to temperament for other researchers. And so one of my favorite questions years ago used to be, you know, does personality and temperament overlap and in what ways? But I'm not asking that kind of question this year. Look at the sorts of aspects that people look at with temperament, because this does fascinate me. If you end up being the sort of person that does research that entails mother-child observation, often what you're looking at are what are called the formal characteristics of behavior. Like, what's the activity level of the child? Do they never sit still? How rhythmical are they? Do they have patterned little bursts of activity and then bursts of calm and quiet? How adaptable are they? Do they respond to absolutely everything, or it takes a very loud noise before they respond? And how intensely do they react when they do respond? Okay, so it's the kind of formal features of behavior. But you've also got things like the quality of mood, how distractible or how attentive they are, and how much they persist, or do they get really mad if they're playing with a toy, but they can't solve the problem? Do they smash it? Okay. And there's all sorts of different ways that people have tried to underpin temperament differences, like Zuckerman's sensation-seeking scale. He thought it was the cortical reticular formation loop that determined that. Pavlov had a look at both strength of excitation. In other words, even if the world is throwing an awful lot of stimulation at you, do you still absolutely engage in that activity? So if I gave you a chance to, say you're a cricketer, and I say, would you like to play with the Australian cricket team for 10 minutes, right? If you said yes, you'd probably be fairly high on strength of excitation, right? Because you're prepared to go into a very challenging arena. Strength of inhibition is things like Can you stop yourself from criticizing someone just because they're irritating you? Or can you let a shot that's probably not going to hit the wickets go past you rather than have a go at it and get out? And then mobility of nervous system. Can you work right up to the last minute before you're going out to a party? Or do you get into party mode, you know, 4 hours in advance and you can't settle to do anything? That means you haven't got such a high mobility of temperament. And obviously you can find tricky ways of handling that, because a lot of what I think personality is learning how to manage the kind of temperament that you've got. Now, extroversion correlates with mobility of temperament, and neuroticism correlates negatively with all three. So having good inhibition, a strong excitation, and mobility of nervous system is a good sign for not ending up neurotic in the sense of being unable to terminate negative emotional states when they arise. And so Strelow actually thought that we didn't just passively endure our temperament. He thought that what we did was we tried to manage the kind of nervous activity that we found ourselves faced with. We tried to find the optimal level of arousal for our personality, for our temperamental style. And so we'd either become a librarian or a kind of mountain climber, depending on whether or not we were a high reactive or a low reactive, respectively. So the defining features of temperament are that it tends to be biologically specified. You notice it really, really early in childhood. And callous unemotionality in psychopaths tends to be of this kind, which is why people tend to think of it as almost a temperament variable, because it seems to be there right from the early start. Usually with temperament features, it's stuff that's true of humans and animals, and it tends to be something that's quite stable. I don't know about you, but I've certainly noticed that I've learned how to handle my temperament. I'm quite pacey. But if a car backfires, I still jump, you know, 4 feet into the air. It's like I've never learned how to damp that bit down, you know, even with, you know, all the yoga in the world, basically. So the formal characteristics of your behavior tend to give you away, you know, virtually to the end of your life. So that's what you look at. You sort of look at things like the briskness of someone's action. Are they speedy in everything they do? Do they hang in there? Are they perseverant? How sensitive are they to sensory stimulation? You know, is the world too much for them? Their computer screens too bright, that kind of thing. How emotionally reactive are they? Because these are the things that might influence things like stress response. We might all have been on a ferry that sunk, but some of us might have been up that night telling great stories and laughing about it, and others would be, you know, shaking for weeks, basically. How endurant are we? How much can we keep on keeping on? And what's our activity levels? A lot of the stuff that you see in the literature now, and I'm going to pick up on a later lecture, about mental toughness, resilience, coping strategies, there's a big component of temperament in there. But a lot of it is also how you learn to think about things. So it's not just your body, it's also your manner of thought that shapes it as well. Now, all that slide is saying is that most of what shapes your temperament is your inherited biological attributes. But a good half of it is, or 46%, is due to experience and learning. So don't give up hope. If you've got a weak nervous system with low mobility, all is not lost. Okay. Because the next step in the cascading constraint trajectory is, in a sense, we learn how to live in our bodies by how attuned people are to what we're feeling. It's a really huge pivotal focus in developmental research, psychoanalytic research, cognitive research, is that first few formative months of you relating to somebody else. If you've got what's called intersubjective attunement with the person that's in the world alongside you, your bodily signals feel much more real to you. If you're experiencing pleasure and the parent is letting you know that they can see you're enjoying things and they reflect back to you in some way that you're experiencing pleasure, you go, oh, gosh, my pleasure is visible to someone external in the world. And what that does is make you think, oh, so that's real, you know. But it also means that if someone is attuned and sharing that emotion with you, You don't feel alone. You don't think the only person that can manage this or handle this is me, and I don't know what to do. It's like, here's this other person attuned and soothing me in some ways. So the kinds of paralinguistic things, like the sounds that people make when babies are distressed or when they injure themselves, is a way of keying into what the child is experiencing and then changing what the child experiences. So it might be, oh, but the voice, you know, drops down to something soothing. So I suppose the residue of attunement, the outcome of attunement, what you get from having been attuned by someone else, is that your bodily signals feel real, they feel manageable, and they might feel meaningful to you. And this is utterly pivotal. Yeah. Does it enhance the feelings? It can do either, I suppose, because attunement, I suppose, means that the parent can pick up on what the child is feeling. And if the child is not all that full of joy, say, at getting a toy, the parent might enhance it, saying it's okay to be goofy and feel joy. But if it's real distress and it's not actually such a serious injury, the parent might attenuate or drop back the baby's feeling, in a sense, by saying, yes, it's a scratch, but, you know, it's okay. It's not like a broken bone. So it's more like modulating it. Yeah, it's not necessarily going to enhance or diminish. It depends on where the child needs to go to get the right response for that culture. Because there'll be certain cultures where if you're not going, oh, my God, that's fantastic, it's like you're strange. You know, there'll be other cultures where if you go, oh, my God, that's fantastic, you'll be really strange. Like Scottish people don't do things like that, you know. So that's when you start to get fitting into your culture too, or fitting into your family. And they may have different rules from your culture in a sense. But this is really pivotal because next week I'm going to be talking to you about neurotic, borderline, psychotic. And I just need to let you know that this level is the most important in terms of borderline levels of organization. If you can't bear your own bodily signals, it's not good. Okay. Watch this space, but it's not good. If you can't tolerate what your body's telling you, and your strategy is avoidance, avoidance isn't a real good strategy, okay? None of the data suggests that just straight out avoidance in the long term is a good thing. So at some stage in our lives, we're going to have to handle what the body's throwing our way, okay? And we may not find that easy, especially, say I'm incredibly terrified, but guess what? It's my caregivers that are terrifying me. They're the ones that are supposed to be attuned to me and teaching me how to soothe my own feelings. And they're the problem, right? Not a great start. You have to find somebody else or some other way of soothing your feelings. Okay. So misattunement. If nobody's actually mirroring back or reflecting back your inner experiences, what that means is that there's nobody there going, oh, I see that you're enjoying that toy. That's great, you know. Or like, wow, they're sharing the experience with you. And if nobody's doing that, you're going, great toy, don't worry, it doesn't matter if you go, okay, it just all goes away. Or if you're distressed and instead of coming to you, people just go, oh, God, that baby, could you shut the door? I can't read with that baby crying, right? They're left to their own devices. I guess if we're not soothed and or if there's abuse, we may actually think there's nothing I can do with these bodily signals, so I'm going to pretend they're not there. And it may be a form of dissociating or avoiding or not knowing that the body is signaling something to you. And that's the beginning of alexithymia, which you all know you can measure. It's got three different subscales. If you have got alexithymia, you can't find the words for feelings, you can't name them. It means you don't know what your body's signaling to you. And it means you can get the wrong idea of what your body's signaling to you and start to be afraid of your body in all sorts of interesting ways. So if the bodily signals feel overwhelming, it's very easy for us to attempt to avoid knowing their input. And I know that sounds strange, but it's very common. So what the message of this is, if you've got attunement, somebody's going, yep, what you're feeling is real. I can see it. I can join in with it. And it's all yours, baby. Right? You go, oh, I've got a proto sense of self. But if that other person is going, I really sense your feeling and I'm conveying that to you in some way, at a distance, I'm not taking over your experience, but I'm conveying that I can pick up on your experience, then you start to get a sense of other. Now, this is the beginning of theory of mind, knowing that I'm a person in a world of others who are similarly minded to me. And that's something that narcissistically inclined people don't do so well, psychopathically inclined people don't do so well, and Machiavellian people don't do so well. In other words, there's lots more bells and whistles that get added on to this proto-sense of self and this proto-sense of other, but this is the beginning of it. And so the early months of life are quite formative. And there's a lot going on, even though it's outside of language. There's an awful lot going on. If not saying too much, you're sort of drawing conclusions about the world. You're drawing conclusions about other people. You're drawing conclusions in some ways about yourself. And so that prototype of a sense of self, world, and other is already starting to form in the very early stages. So a lot of what contributes to a sense of self, and that's a big theme in the course, a sense of self, starts right now with your bodily phenomenology. What am I feeling? What am I feeling? What's the content of my experience? But then how do I attend to that? Am I detached? You know, I think my heart rate's going up, not I'm afraid, right? There's some people that take their feelings apart. If you say, how are you feeling now? They might say, well, my palms are sweating and my heart is racing and I don't feel like approaching that thing, right? Okay? Analytic. They're taking it apart. You ask me, what are you feeling? Terrified. Synthetic. I see fear all of the piece, right? I name it. But some people don't. They break it apart. Ruminative. I'm feeling really afraid. Do you think that's bad? I don't think it's so good. But I'm so afraid. I've been afraid for days and I've been thinking about it and I can't stop thinking about it. I'm not just afraid of the initial thoughts. Now I'm afraid of the fact that I've been thinking about it for so long. Does this mean, do you think I'm going mad? Do you know? Okay, ruminative, right? Reflective. It's like, oh God, I'm getting into one of those spirals again. It's all right. They go away. I just need to go for a bit of a run or eat some chocolate, right? Reflective. This is me having those feelings because I'm terrified of exams again, but it's all right. I, you know, don't usually die, et cetera, et cetera. Right? More reflective. You've got the wider view, right? Reflective is always the way to go if you can manage it, but don't beat yourself up if ruminative is the way that you sometimes go, because most of us do. But then what does it mean? This is where you actually try to put some kind of cognitive description on what you're doing. Like if I'm a real, real ruminator, I might not stop there. I say, God, I'm so neurotic, right? Man, you know, okay, that's my description. Or I might not do that. I might just say, this is what happens to me when I have too much coffee, okay? In other words, you impose a certain meaning on your bodily experience. But say I've been raised in a particular culture and I'm a boy, and I'm feeling utterly terrified. And I've been taught that it's the most unmanly thing in the world to have fear. Then I feel shame. So every time I feel fear, I feel shame. Or if I'm a woman and I've been taught that it's unfeminine to have anger, when I feel fury and anger, I weep, right? I burst into tears because there's no socially appropriate outlet for anger. If you're socialized in a particular way to be a woman. So in other words, it's not just the emotions you have feelings about those feelings. If I'm a boy and I've been socialized in a particular way, I feel ashamed of being afraid. That's a meta emotion or a nested emotion. If I'm a woman, I've been socialized in a particular way. If I feel angry, I feel despair or I don't know, I just weep. Right? Men never say yes to that question. We have the data. Women, if you give them a sort of on a Likert scale, their mean is around 0.46. The mean for guys, I'm delighted to say some guys will say yes to that, is about 1.6, but it's hugely significant differences. This is in an adolescent population of the 15 to 17-year-olds. So really interesting meta-emotion differences. So in a sense, the body's always at us. There's always heaps going on at a bodily level. Thank goodness we don't attend to it all the time because there's too much happening there. But we tend to sample our body. We just kind of dip in and work out what's going on there. And we do so in different ways. And that's what I want to convey to you, that the body's not the end of the story. How you attend to the body is also part of the story. And you can change that. You can't necessarily change what the body's signaling to you when you're first born, but you can change how you attend to that. And that has an effect, a knock-on effect in some ways. Your body doesn't feel so scary if you can change it by the way that you pay attention to it. So how we sample our body is shaped by affects like shame and disgust. Like if we've been brought up with a strong prohibition against sexual desire or masturbation, we're not going to want to know about our own sexual desire. If other people think we're pathetic when we're needy, we're not going to want to show our need very much. So in other words, our attitude to our whole feeling world is shaped by things like the sort of attachment styles that we develop, and is shaped by things like the kinds of affective schemas that we have that help us make sense of both ourselves, the world, and other people. Okay, so what I see as a working model, an inner working model, which is what Bowlby says you get out of attachment, I just see that as a schema. It's just a knowledge structure, but it's a hot knowledge structure. It's got an affect that really seals it and fuses all the components of it together, if you like. So if, for instance, you have been born luckily into a world where when you show stress or fear, somebody's there and they offer you care and protection, you go, great, now I can explore the world. Okay? So you internalize those working models. And not only does that really shape what you expect about future relationships, but it also gives you kind of unwritten or unspoken rules for what you experience, express, and do with your emotions. And it's usually all at the procedural level. Like if you cry and cry and cry and your mother goes, oh, or if you cry and cry and cry and she goes, oh, right? It's going to have an effect on you in terms of how likely it is that doing those things brings an available, sensitive, responsive, effective other person to your aid. So mirroring, and Peter Fonagy uses this in quite a fascinating sort of way. What he means by marked means I'm mirroring your response, but I'm doing something that reveals to you that this is me mirroring your response. I'm not taking over your sadness, or I'm not having your joy for you. So, for instance, you might be expressing your joy verbally, and I might share that joy by leaping up and down on the spot. So in other words, I'm sharing something of your joy, but it's marked in some way, like it's in a different sensory modality, so that you know I'm not trying to take over your particular transaction with the world. And so it's that reflecting back in the moment, contingently, but in a marked sort of way that really promotes a child's social cognition. It means that they mentalize earlier, they can think about their own minds, they can think about other people having minds, they can think about coping strategies, and it's highly predictive of later social competence. So mirroring or mentalizing, as it's referred to in the more psychoanalytic literature, is a really powerful contributor to social cognition and the development of it. So significant others offer distress alleviation and support and comfort, we all know that. Okay, so what an attachment style is, and I know you know this from heaps of other courses, so apologies if I'm covering ground that you're all too familiar with, but it's a kind of set of relational expectations that you've got, and it means that the particular history you've had with somebody has ended up inside you in some way. You've internalized that history. You know there's no point crying because your mother just shut the door. Or you know there's no point screaming because your father just, you know, turns the motor mower up louder. And so what attachment means, you can key into someone's history in some way. You can say, how anxious are they about intimacy? How do they avoid intimacy? And why do they avoid intimacy? Are they fearful or are they dismissive? And they also, you can also predict other things like how they are likely to regulate their emotions as a result of the kind of attachment style that they've got. And there's been some really cool work done showing that if you prime threat words, people are much faster at picking up on proximity-related words like love and closeness. So even mentally we go, ah, threat, oh, love, comfort, soothing. Now, what secure attachment offers, and this is one of the reasons I'm so fascinated by the positive emotions, is that if you're securely attached, you can forget about having to stay on side with your mum or your caretaker or your father. You can focus on the world and explore, and that's being set free in some way. You don't have to worry about whether they like you or not. And so it promotes really constructive, reality-attuned, flexible mechanisms. So a good start in life is a great thing, but if you didn't have it, you're going to have to find other ways of explicitly noting that you might have, say, insecure attachment that makes you predisposed to see the world in different ways. So securely attached people know that if they show distress, they get support. And so securely attached people are, interestingly, much less hostile to outgroup members, much more empathic towards people in need. They've been kindly treated. In turn, that's their modus operandi when interacting with the world. Whereas there's two different ways of being insecurely attached. You can either be preoccupied. In other words, you can't forget about the other person because they might abandon you. The next thing you do might be the thing that makes them never want to see you again, okay? So you've got to keep them in mind. You've got to keep thinking about them. And if you're thinking about them, you can't just look at, oh, gee, look at that lovely little frog. What does it do? You know, you can't just focus on the world. But then, so you're preoccupied. You're holding out the hope that you can retain love. If you're avoidant, it's like, no way, that's a dead loss. I'm not going to be interested in getting attachment from them. That's the dismissive. But you might also be avoidant because, oh, I've been close to people before. It never works out. It's really terrible. I'm not going to be close to them, right? Different ways of being avoidantly attached. And so with borderline personality disorder, what you find, and I saw this fantastic lecture about Thursday of last week from a guy from Bochum University, amazing experimental research psychiatrist who knew his psychoanalysis. It's really great to see. And he said that borderline personality disorder is linked to an inability to be attached and also to be able to mentalize at the same time. So weirdly, it becomes you either, you know, get concerned with sustaining your connection to the caregiver, or you are allowed to think, right? And the two things don't seem to coexist.
That was Lecture 23 from the series Philosophy of Psychoanalysis, presented by Associate Professor Doris McElwain. The theme song to the show was created by Rose Mackenzie Peterson. The producer is myself, Nina McElwain. Thanks to Andrew Jeeves and John Sutton. Speak soon.